products they like to the organizations that are able to pivot. So when we came back, we were telling them about a pivot that we'd made in one of our strategies. And we didn't really think this was going to yield a check, but it did. So it just goes to show the importance of actually being mindful and intentional about what it is that your donors are really interested in.
Welcome to the Seven Figure Fundraising Podcast, the podcast where we discuss specific tactics and strategies to grow your nonprofit. I'm your host, Trevor Bragdon. Today's guest is Elaine Olowo-Matovu and Takako Mino. They are the founders of a new university in Uganda called Musisi University. And I met Elaine and Takako through our seven-figure fundraising class when they were just starting out with just the idea of founding a brand new university in Uganda. So we're having them on the podcast. It's been a year and a half since they started fundraising. We want to learn, first, what it's like to start a new university, and then second, what it's like fundraising for the first time and really figuring out fundraising on the fly while building a university. So welcome to the show, Elaine and Takako.
Thank you.
Thank you, Trevor. We're so happy to be here.
Yeah, well, I'm glad you guys could have the time to meet with us and talk about Musisi University. And for those who don't know, Uganda, just to give you some reference, Uganda is in East Africa. So it's right next door to Kenya and Tanzania and the Democratic Republic of Congo. It has about 47 million people, and it's roughly the size of Oregon. So that kind of gives you a quick reference of where we're talking. But Elaine, talk about what inspired you to start Musisi University, and what was the vision that you had for starting this?
Thank you so much, Trevor, for having us on this show. And well, you know, I was born and raised in Uganda. I went to school in Uganda. I live in Uganda, well, between Uganda and the Netherlands. And, you know, Uganda right now is sort of at a crossroads. We have 43 million people and one of the fastest growing populations in the world, but with an education system that's, you know, not catching up with how fast the population is growing. In terms of, you know, just infrastructure, but also the sort of content that's taught and whether that content is actually meeting the needs of the economy as it is, you know, growing and changing. And so usually to mitigate this sort of shortfall, we as a country tend to send our best and brightest to leading universities abroad on scholarships. But with a sort of population growth that we have, and I don't know if I told you that we also have the second youngest population in the world.
Oh, wow.
With a median age of 14.
Wow, so lots of people coming into university age, right?
Exactly. You know, so the whole scholarship model would just never be sustainable. So it therefore became imperative that we create a world-class university in Uganda that would teach students within their context to solve their own problems. And I think for me, that was the big inspiration.
That's great. And how does it work? Like, how are you planning to have the university run? I know you haven't quite started, but how are you planning? Like, what makes it unique from the more Western models?
So, I mean, there's things that are definitely going to be similar. One of the things that is going to be similar is that we've chosen a liberal arts model. And although we call it a liberal arts model, it's actually, when you think about it, the way that we always educated people in Africa before the whole colonial system came in and then narrowed down our learning into these specializations that we are now stuck within the legacy systems where people come into university to study law and engineering and medicine. But it was always the case that somebody got a broad and wide education and they studied, you know, about the behavior of people and the people that they lived with and the ones that were the neighbors of the ones that they lived with, you know. Like we always looked at education in a more multidimensional way. And then when that changed and we went to this very specialized way of doing things. What has happened is that you get individuals who are very sort of skilled, but perhaps not well-rounded in terms of understanding the context, the wider context of problems. So yes, you have amazing engineers, but they might not necessarily understand the social minutiae around some of the things that they are trying to engineer around. And so I think this is the thing that will make Masisi different from the current existing universities. But from universities abroad is that obviously because we've chosen this model, we want it to also refocus indigeneity. The idea of knowing has been sort of politicized so that you have this idea where knowledge flows from one side, usually the global west, down to the global south. And yet it should actually be a two-way direction. Professor Ngugi wa Thiong'o calls it from here to there and from there to here, a mutual illumination. And that can only happen if, as African universities, we recenter our ways of knowing, our indigenous ways of knowing, and contribute them into the world body of knowledge.
That's great. Well, and I think what's cool and what's fun about this model and how you're approaching it is like how you're mixing both, like you said, the local knowledge, but also like best practices and things that are working in the West and kind of putting those together rather than saying like, oh, our ways of doing things are wrong or bad. Instead, like both can have great value, but it's a mix of them and applying it so you have that context to be effective as a leader in Uganda.
Yeah.
So Takako, talk to us about how you and Elaine co-founded this university together. How did that happen?
Well, I came from a background in education. I was born in Japan, grew up in the U.S., and had an opportunity to study at a small liberal arts college in Southern California called Clermont McKenna College. And during that time, I studied abroad in Uganda. So that was my first experience in Uganda. And what really touched me at that time was how much Ugandans valued education and sacrificed so much to be able to access an education. And there was just this very strong belief that education was the best way to transform their destiny and to transform their families and their communities. So I picked up an interest in education because of my experience there, and later had the opportunity to teach in Uganda and met amazing young people who are just thirsty to learn and so eager to take whatever they can learn from their education and to be able to apply it to make a difference in their communities. So that inspired me to continue my career as an educator and to understand how to do education from the inside. I eventually came back to the U.S., became a high school teacher, obtained my PhD in education, and had an opportunity to work at a very innovative startup university, also a liberal arts model, in the Ghanaian context, and to learn from them about how they were able to make their school successful over the last 20 years. When the pandemic hit, this was in March of 2020, right in the beginning of it, through random networking, I wanted to figure out some way to give back to Uganda after everything that I've learned from there and contribute to the development of the higher education system in Uganda. I knew that I didn't have in a complete enough background to do that. So I was looking for a partner who had more of a business background, who had experience running a startup in Uganda, and who also could really understand the unique cultural context of Uganda. So through random networking, I was introduced to Elaine. And it turns out that she was also looking for somebody with an academic background to work with. And when we had our first phone conversation in March of 2020, we realized that we had a shared vision and shared values. And we asked each other, could we work on this crazy project together? And 6 months later, 3 days after the airport reopening, I was in Uganda on the ground to work with Elaine. So for the last 3 years, we've been working together to develop our concept, to do our market research, and to also start our fundraising journey.
That's awesome, Takako. And talk to us, like, what is the you worked at this innovative university in Ghana. What makes this university unique, and how you're planning to use Musisi University and provide really valuable education at a low cost to people right there in Uganda?
We learned a lot from the university in Ghana. And I think we've had to figure out how to tailor what we can learn from that to the Ugandan context, where there's even more challenges in terms of the strength of the economy and the resilience of the business ecosystem to produce employment opportunities. So in terms of finding pipelines to employment, I think Uganda is in a much more difficult place than Ghana. So in structuring how we created the educational experience for the students, we had to be even more intentional about making sure that whatever degrees that we offered would directly lead into employment for the students, and that we would basically create steps for the students to slowly integrate into the industry and become familiar with it. So what we've done is we've chosen degrees that are highly employable and are able to be offered even with low resources and are of high interest to students and parents. So those degrees are entrepreneurship, software engineering, and health data analytics. And how we've structured all of these degrees is that students learn by doing. So for the entrepreneurship program, all the students have to start their own business. And the point is that we want them to fail fast and learn the realities of trying to make a business work in Uganda, so that they can come out with a lot more confidence by the time they finish their program to actually thrive within this difficult context. Or if they don't want to be entrepreneurs, that they could go into companies and help propel the growth of other companies and contribute to creating more jobs through that. Same with the software engineers. In traditional software engineering programs, you learn a lot of theory first, like a lot of math, and then you kind of go into the programming. But for us, the students will code from day one, and they will just get lots of hands-on experiences where they come out with multiple projects that they've been able to complete and show to employers that we've been able to create these applications already and have the confidence and skill set that are required to keep on doing this in the real work world. So I think that's the part where we've had to be much, much more intentional. And then also the other aspect that's different for us is even more focus on the unique Ugandan context. So one of the things that we're going to offer to the students is indigenous language lessons. They're going to have the opportunity to take Luganda, which is very common business language here in Uganda, so that if they are able to know both Luganda and English very well, it actually makes them super flexible and effective employees and entrepreneurs who can work with people across a wide variety of contexts in Uganda and make a bigger impact. So these are the ways that we've tried to just think through the processes as clear as possible so that we can make sure that students will go right into jobs after they finish at Musisi.
That's really great. And I think it's what's interesting is you're addressing one of like the knocks on a liberal arts degree that you hear here in the US is, you know, it's great you have that English liberal arts degree, but you can only get a job at Starbucks or something like that, versus you guys are starting at the beginning, really thinking of, we want this to be a liberal arts college, but also learn really hard, tangible skills that equate to jobs heading out. And I love that, you know, they're learning to code on day one, starting a business, like very real, tangible, and really useful skills to have. That's great. So Elaine, what does Musisi mean?
I love that question. This is my favorite question always. So the Musisi is an indigenous tree that grows in Uganda. It is normally strewn across coffee plantations and cocoa plantations. And as you know, Uganda has one of the best coffee, Robusta coffees in the world, and also the purest cocoa, you know, which makes the highest percentage pure chocolate in the world. It's not 100%, it's about 80%, but, you know, anyway, the firstest off the shelves. And so the Musisi is strewn across these plantations because it allows just enough amount of sunshine and shade to give both the coffee and the cocoa, you know, a strong aroma that makes the coffee really rich and also makes the cocoa, eventually the chocolate, have a very deep and rich flavor. And so our hope is that our students will be the Misizi of their communities without, you know, playing zero-sum games, knowing that there is enough to go around for everybody and that everybody can thrive. The other interesting thing about the Misizi tree is that it grows really tall and straight. And our hope is that our students will be ethical and straight, you know, be ethical leaders like the Misizi tree stands tall. Also, because of how tall the tree grows, birds tend to perch on top of it and drop seeds around it. So you often find various life forms, especially of fruit trees, around the Misizi tree when it's not in a coffee plantation. And so the word Misizi comes from the word, the Bantu word to sow. So the Misizi is the sowing tree. And our hope is that our students will be the Misizi of their communities, being catalysts for change and growth, sowing growth and change wherever they go. And that's, for us, very, very exciting.
So one other question just about the business model, and then we'll move into fundraising. Elaine, talk to us about how you're mixing, like with the professors and the training, like how you're mixing both West and Ugandan talent and putting those together in kind of this interesting hybrid model.
Yeah. So first of all, let me just say a little bit more about the question you'd asked earlier, the point you made earlier on the interesting difference between, you know, what people typically think about when they think about a liberal arts education. Because what we did is that we're using the liberal arts model to solve a specific problem. And that specific problem for us is a lack of a history. You know, I mean, one of the things that bonded me and Takako a lot when we first met to talk about Uganda, because Takako had done her undergraduate thesis on how history is taught in schools in the region. And believe it or not, Trevor, most people like me and know the history of this country from the day John Speak walked in. So nothing is known about what was going on here before John Speak walked in. And things like that can have a very debilitating impact and effect on how people view themselves and their ability to solve their own problems. So we're not choosing a liberal arts model for the sake of a liberal arts model. We are choosing it because it is an absolute necessity for us to regain our confidence and understand the context within which we live, and also to help our students basically believe that they are not a summation of their lowest common, you know, the lowest moments in their history, because that is the history that they know. Oh yeah, you guys were colonized in this year, and then in this year you did this, and then you had Amin who chased away the Indians, and then did this, and then this, and that. And then you had civil war for so many years, and then basically that's why you are what you are. And nobody teaches Ugandans in school that, oh, you came from an amazing civilization where the first successful C-section in the world was recorded before anybody else in the world was doing C-sections. And in fact, there's history of the fact that you were doing inoculations way before vaccination happened. Oh, and you know the 100 years of the Sultan of Oman occupying Zanzibar? That ended because a Ugandan guy started a revolution that basically sent the Oman packing, and his name was John Okello. Nobody teaches anybody that sort of stuff. So our approach to a liberal arts education is not sort of the romantic, and I'm not saying that's what it is in the States, but it is not a luxury. I hear, you know, when I was in the US, people said, liberal arts, well, you guys don't have the luxury of that. And I didn't quite understand why they were saying it that way. But now I sort of understand that people do sort of feel that a liberal arts education is a good to have. Like you said, you have a liberal arts education, and what are you doing with it? for us, it is an absolute necessity for anybody, whether they're going to be an engineer, whether they're going to be a software engineer, whether they're going to be a data analyst, and whether they're going to be an entrepreneur. We have to have an understanding of who we are. Now, from that point, I can then begin to explain to you the sort of professors that we're looking for and why we've, you know, been looking for those sort of professors. Because on the one hand, we want the cutting edge expertise in areas like computer science and AI technology and data analytics. But at the same time, we need professors that know about African history and anthropology and that sort of thing, so that we can be able, and by African history, I'm talking about pre-colonial African history, so that we can get the best of both worlds.
Gotcha. And how are you going to do that with the two, you know, professors who are kind of world-class in computer science and then also have teachers there locally in Uganda?
So that's obviously always going to be a challenge, especially for a new project that's working on a modest budget. And so what we've done is that we are looking to have a blended model where we have some in-person classes and where we are able to also have some online classes, which can be given by adjunct professors who are not necessarily domiciled in Uganda, but who have a support, a team of tutors that would probably be young Ugandan academics that are being mentored by the said professor. And that way, we'll be able to sort of merge the best of both worlds. And one of the exciting things that's happened, you know, in this journey is that we found a lot of people that are excited to work with us, Ugandan academics in the diaspora who are, you know, teaching at these world-class universities that are willing to be adjunct professors for us. Some of them are also leading industry professionals who are willing also to be adjunct professors. So this is very, very exciting for us that we are able to get this model, because perhaps there's been a lot of interest in teaching, but realistically, perhaps people might feel encumbered if you had to require them to come and live in Uganda. You know, we've got some problems here that make it not the most ideal place to want to live. So that's how we're looking at it. And the exciting thing is that having that opportunity for mentorship for young Ugandan academics means that there'll be a transfer of skills and, you know, just a kaleidoscope of experiences that the students will be able to benefit from. So we are excited about that.
That's really cool. And I think it's such a clever model, because you talk about, you know, how you want to build this history that's really not there, this base of history with your students. They only know the last 200 years, not, you know, what a great nation and great people Ugandans were, but also like tapping into this network of Ugandans all around the world who have gone on and, you know, are professors in the United States or professors in England or the UK. And getting those professors, you know, do a class, teach your world class in this expertise, teach a class, you know, via Zoom or online, have TAs locally working with your students locally. So it's this great hybrid model. I think it's really unique and clever. You're blending both of those. So you have those deep cultural roots, so you can get that rounded education, but also having the world class Ugandans who, you know, are in New York or California or whatever. And, you know, maybe the time zones might be a little different figuring that all out, but it's a really cool way to tap into such a great knowledge base.
Yeah, and I mean, it's not only Ugandans, by the way. It's, you know, we've got some Ugandans. That was exciting because that's a big plus. I keep saying, you know, people look at countries and say, what's Uganda's biggest problem? And we are, you know, I was looking at the list of the 50 poorest countries in the world, and I think we were number 17 or something like that, or 23. I mean, at that point, it really doesn't matter. If you make it to the list, it's bad enough. And the funny thing is, I don't think that our biggest problem is poverty. I think our biggest problem is a lack of confidence, because the country is rich. It's got amazing weather. It's got great soils. We literally could be the food basket of the continent, or even of the world. But if people don't have the confidence to, embark on, endeavors that can create meaningful and dignified jobs and work, no amount of money is going to solve that problem. And so, to that point, therefore, having Ugandans that are thriving in the diaspora be a part of the adjunct faculty is it's not just good because of the exposure and the knowledge that they have teaching in these universities abroad, but it's also important for the confidence building. But we are also excited about the non-Ugandan adjunct professors that have agreed to work with us. I mean, it's actually very, very heartwarming and exciting to have, the opportunity to literally bring the world to our students. Like they said, if you can't take Muhammad to the mountain, maybe you'll try taking the mountain to Muhammad.
Yeah, no, that's great. And I love the business model. I think it's really clever. So you talked about confidence, like part of the problem in Uganda is people don't have enough confidence, but you guys have a lot of confidence when it comes to fundraising, where you started with this brand new idea, brand new business model. So talk to us about, how did you approach fundraising for a startup? Because this is a new idea, and for you, Takako, kind of a new place. You were living in a different country. You fly in 2 days after airports open up in 2020, and you get on the ground. You're like, okay, we're going to start a university. How does that work, and how do you guys start fundraising for it?
Well, first of all, I think we had to start with ourselves. So in the initial stages, and this was before we took your class and learned more about the nuts and bolts behind fundraising, we started with ourselves. So Elaine and I put in some of our own investment into some of the things that would be required to get things moving. So there was bootstrapping from both of us that happened of about $100,000. And then in the process of that, we began to apply to get a 501c3 status in the U.S., and once we were able to obtain that, we were able to first approach our family and friends. And this actually kind of happened naturally, because I think we've had this habit throughout our whole journey of seeking advice about our project from lots of different people. So this kind of continual conversation has kept people updated and kept people engaged, so that by the time we were getting to that point where we were fundraising, we already had a relationship with these people who have been advising us. So many of them have become our initial donors and our early adopters, like we like to call them, who gave us a chance on this very bold and daring project. I think also what we learned once we were able to join your class is how to reach out to people beyond this network, because in terms of our family and friends, we didn't have too many people who had a lot of capacity. So we learned how to reach out to people and cultivate relationships with other kinds of individuals who may not have had direct relationships with us, but who we could somehow get connected to. And then what we decided to do is basically do some research on other universities that are similar. So similar African startup universities, and find out who funded them. And then from there, find out how we can get warm introductions to these people. Because that's one thing that we learned from your class, is that it makes a huge world of a difference if somebody who is trusted introduces you, rather than you just approaching them through a cold email. So those kinds of warm introductions enabled us to connect with people who had no connections with us before, but who had funded similar projects. So those are the ways that we initially started up. And our reflection from this is that even if it's been really tough to start up this way, in a way that is the opposite of how other universities have started up, other universities have typically started with a very wealthy funder who had kind of given the go-ahead to start the project in the first place, and that's how the project happens. In our case, we've started with the idea, but then without money. So in a way, it's been really tough, but in another sense, it's been great, because because of that, we've been able to build a village around us of volunteers and interns who have given us so much in-kind support. So, for example, I would say that we have been a student-powered startup. We've had over 20 different interns work with us over the years, and some of them coming to Uganda from my alma mater, and some of them coming from Ashesi University, the university where I used to work in Ghana, and them providing their support. But working with these volunteers and interns have been great because students especially are the closest to understanding the value of a higher education and the closest to evaluating it and thinking about how to make it better. So that's how we've hobbled along in the beginning of our fundraising journey.
And I got to meet you guys in person when you were on just recently on a fundraising tour here in the US. Talk to me a little bit about how that went. You know, you were going around the country. I think you stopped in six or seven different major cities. I got to meet you guys in DC. But talk to me about how that fundraising went. And then how did you go about, you know, pitching a university to people who had never been to Uganda? How did that work? And what was that like?
So just starting off with the second part of your question about the lack of familiarity with Uganda, I think that was one of our biggest challenges, is that lots of people have never been there. And as Elaine mentioned before, there's a lot of misconceptions about Uganda too, and a lot of negative associations that people have made about things that they've heard about Uganda. So part of our journey was helping people learn about Uganda and to make a human connection to it, to understand the people, the real human needs behind this project, to talk about people like the students at Elaine's school. We haven't mentioned this yet, but Elaine has started a very successful kindergarten through end of high school education system in Uganda that has been able to educate hundreds of young Ugandans who are looking forward to better higher education opportunities. And so speaking about stories of those young people, what they're looking forward to and what they wouldn't have if they don't have access to attending Musizi, help people understand why this project is important and how it's going to really help address the unemployment challenge in Uganda and help build the business ecosystem that can help the country thrive. The other aspect that has helped us along our journey, because we don't have a track record as a startup university, is talking about Elaine School, because that builds so much credibility around our operational experience in Uganda. Elaine has been able to make a school work within the Ugandan context, to grow it from 30 students in 2017 to almost 900 students, from $30,000 of seed capital to now $3 million of annual revenue, and also to be able to start the first endowment fund of a school, of an indigenous-led school in Uganda. So her school has been able to make so many impossible things possible that that helps build a lot of confidence about us making a similarly ambitious project a reality within the Ugandan context. So these kinds of conversations were very helpful in just deepening understanding and deepening connection to what we're trying to achieve in Uganda.
I think one of the things that became very clear is that certainly the idea of having warm introductions that is definitely very, very important. And as Takako said, you know, I don't even need to belabor this point. Context. If people don't understand the context that you're operating in, it's very difficult for them to want to give. But perhaps even more importantly is for us also to understand their context. What matters to them? What are the things that they are interested in? And having to understand that, I think, was a big help for us. So in fact, in this trip where we met you, really, although we were open to receiving donations, it was really a relationship building trip for us, as it was my first time to come to the US since we started this project. So a lot of the people that we met were people who we had perhaps spoken to on a Zoom call, but who we hadn't had a real opportunity to meet in person and have them ask us questions, but also have an opportunity to ask them the things that mattered to them, what sort of organizations they are interested in supporting, and also just giving them the comfort of seeing us and knowing who we are. Because, you know, I've heard it said that people do not give money to projects, they give money to people. And to an extent, that is really true. But at the same time, people are not going to be moved until you are speaking a language that matters to them and you're actually meeting them at a point where you're resonating with the things that they're interested in. So I think it was really wonderful to find people with whom we had those sort of connections. It's like a magical moment when that happens, you know, the sort of thing that you see in Disney where the stars are flying in the air and there's all these butterflies. You just can't see them, but you feel it. And I think that was really exciting.
Yeah, that's such a great point. Like the whole perspective of like being in person, but also thinking about it from this donor or the person you're meeting with, their perspective, you know, they might not really know about Uganda. So you have to fill them in about that. They don't know, you know, about this is a unique model when it comes to the university. So you have to explain that. So there's a lot of education just to bring somebody up to speed where they're even at the point they can make a decision. So it makes sense. It's kind of this two-step approach where you meet on Zoom, you go see them in person, and then you're kind of cultivating this gift. But you guys did have some success, you know, while you were here. You had, I know you've talked to me offline, you're saying how you had two different foundations who fund universities give their first ever donation to a international university startup to your organization. So don't, I don't want you guys to undersell yourself. You know, you need to brag about yourself a little more. You have like two very well-known foundations in the education space donating, and for the first time ever donating to a startup university outside of the US. So it sounds like the trip was a big success for you.
Yes, this was very encouraging to us. And one of them, so they were both family foundations, and one of them was somebody that we were able to connect with because of a warm introduction, and had never given to any international or actually even higher education related initiatives. So this was their first in both areas. And what was exciting about them is that they want to basically grow with us. So they want to see how we do with this gift and then give us more opportunities for bigger gifts in the future. And the other was somebody who knew me from when I was a college student. And so she has kind of watched me on this journey. And we were very surprised because when we met with her, we were going to kind of explain to her how our project was going. But she actually already came with a check ready to give to us. So we were just very moved by that and very encouraged by these first-time gifts from these family foundations.
That's great.
Yeah. And it's also noteworthy that her foundation also hadn't given anything outside of the LA area. In fact, I mean, not just outside of the continent, but generally not outside of LA. So to have received their first international gift, and definitely, that was very heartwarming for us and very, very encouraging.
That's incredible. Well, talk to, just to dive in just a little bit on the tactics here. You mentioned the warm leads and getting like a warm introduction to somebody that you want to reach out to for the first time. Do you want to just take me through how you did that? Like not necessarily mention specific names, but what did that look like? If someone's working at a startup nonprofit right now, thinking about like, oh, okay, there's this donor here I want to get in front of, or this foundation over here. What does that look like in actual practice? How did that, I'm sure it's a lot messier than it's, you know, like the steps, but just kind of give us a quick overview on what that's like.
One of the biggest takeaways from our experience so far is that fundraising is all about human relationships. So every part of this has been about human relationships. So even if we figured out, okay, we want to be able to meet these XYZ people, and then we find within our network who might be connected to any of these people who could actually help us make an introduction. Oftentimes, we first had to cultivate that relationship with the person who was making that introduction in the first place. So that meant that we had to have our pitch ready. And it was so helpful to take your class because we were able to develop our pitch and make sure that we had a consistent story that we could tell, but also adapt to different audiences. So depending upon what exactly was our connection with that person who was introducing us, we would focus on different angles of our project and first develop that relationship with them. And then basically, if they felt compelled enough to make that introduction for us, they would make that introduction. So there was kind of a two-step process involved in making that connection. And so it has been all about relationships, because even if, for example, the person who made a warm introduction to the Family Foundation may not necessarily be that person that you think about as your top dozen donors. That's another strategy that we've learned from you, just like really focusing in on who those top people are. But if it weren't for that person, we would never be able to connect to this other person. So I think in general, just learning how to treasure the different relationships that we have, people are going to play different roles in the fundraising process. Some of the people are going to give directly to us, and some of them are going to introduce us to others who have more capacity. That has been really, really critical, because if it wasn't for a very strong relationship that we had with this person who made that warm introduction, that introduction wouldn't have happened. The other thing is that I think getting in front of people physically just makes a very big difference. It establishes a lot more trust. It creates a lot more excitement. People sometimes remember things that, even if there are people who you've been working with and speaking on Zoom for a long time, somehow when you get in front of them, they remember things that that are really important, or people that they would really like to introduce you to. So I think creating those connections is also great. The other aspect of how we were able to connect with these different organizations was through our connection with the Startup University in Ghana. So they taught us a lot about their fundraising journey, and they've given us a lot of advice and even introduced us to people within their network as well. So our strong relationship with them has also been a very important part of our journey. And then the last thing that I would mention is what you taught us about how to make a pitch, and then also how to kind of give a gift that relates to your pitch, or some kind of item for the person to keep after the pitch. So for us, we've decided what that item is going to be, and we've been using that as part of our pitch. And what we usually do is, so it's coffee, because the Musizi tree is also planted with coffee and shelters the coffee so that it has that that really nice aroma when you're drinking coffee from Uganda. And so when we were doing our pitch, at the end of it, we explain what the Musizi tree is about, and then we also give them the gift of coffee. So it just gives somebody something to remember us with. Whenever they're making coffee, they'll open up that bag again and remember our story, and just give more depth to the short interaction that we were able to have with them. So I think those are some of the strategies. I don't know if Elaine, if there's anything else that we used.
The one thing that we learned again from attending your course is that it's really, really important to be intentional and mindful and present with whoever it is that you're seeking to build a donor relationship with. And I think, you know, this trip, meeting so many of these people, I just got the sense that they're always meeting people that are coming to them to pitch one thing or the other. And sometimes I think they get a little bit exhausted. And I think it's a breath of fresh air when they meet somebody who's actually genuinely interested in what they're interested in. I think sometimes when we write our pitches, because we've worked so hard on them, we are so anxious to get that story in front of this person. But the one donor who came with a check ready at the last meeting that we'd had with them, we already knew that they generally did not give to education. So we spent more time in that conversation, finding out about the sort of people that they would give to, what sort of areas are they interested in, you know, speaking a little bit more about that. And, you know, one of the things that they said, which stood out for us was, interestingly, they mostly support people in tech. And they'd said that, you know, with the tech industry, a lot of things change. So they'd like to see organizations that are able to pivot. So when we came back, we were telling them about a pivot that we'd made in one of our strategies. And we were now speaking to something that we know that they care about, a value that they like to see. And we didn't really think this was going to yield a check, but it did. So it just goes to show the importance of actually being mindful and intentional about what it is that your donors are really interested in. And of course, managing the relationship. Right now, the world is on fire everywhere. It reminds me of, I was telling you, Takako, about this poem by Warsan, where she says, "I took the atlas out and I touched the world map and I asked, where does it hurt? Everywhere, everywhere, everywhere," the map said. And so understanding that we are living in a world that is like that, where there's so much crises everywhere in the world, that there is a chance that the person that you're meeting with is affected by one crisis or the other. Being mindful enough to identify if indeed they are being affected by something that's going on in the world, and being intentional enough to ask them, you know, if they are okay or if their family is okay. I think some of those things, they may seem very, very small. But these are some of the things that we learned from attending your course that made for us a big difference.
This is so great. There's so many points to hit on. I don't know quite where to start. One, the coffee gift that you gave. You gave us a set or a pound of coffee. It's great coffee. So your donors are really lucky to be getting it. But the two, like what I really appreciated when we worked together was how seriously you took the pitch and really thinking through, like, how do we communicate this to donors who don't have background on Uganda, who don't maybe have background in this new type of startup universe. And you guys are very intentional thinking through how to make this feel interesting, but also safe, like that balance of this is a new idea, but Elaine, you had this great background in history starting a school. So yes, it's a school, but you have a great track record with the 700 student school you started from nothing as well. And so like you guys had a very sophisticated pitch, but then you worked on it so much. You also, it sounds like, were very flexible in you're able to pick up on what a donor had said about a pivot and then incorporate that into it. And I think that's the beauty of being really knowledgeable about what you're trying to persuade the donors on, what you're selling, you know, with your pitch, and really intentional about that, but also thinking about them from the donor's perspective of someone who's, you know, a human being who wants to have their money have a lot of impact and wants to meet really fascinating people to work with. And you guys really hit all those boxes. But it's really interesting just watching, you know, both you have all these struggles of starting the university in a country that, you know, there's not a lot of universities there because it's very challenging to start one. But then also like learning these dynamics of fundraising over here in the US, it's very impressive both to see, you know, both sides of it. You know, both would be challenges on their own, and you guys have navigated them really well.
Thank you.
So we're almost out of time, and I want to just always have this podcast be about taking action. And I know you guys, we met because of the podcast. Takako had emailed me. She'd listened to an episode, and that's how we got to know each other originally. So as someone who's listening to this episode, you know, I don't know if they might not be necessarily starting a university, maybe they are, but what advice would you give them? What's actionable advice would you give them that they should go do having listened to this episode?
The first thing is, anytime you have an ambitious idea, and I would like to think that every idea is ambitious because it always seems impossible until it's done. So the first thing is to write it down and make sure that it's very clear that you've researched it. You know all the statistics around it. You understand the problem that you are going to solve and how you're going to solve it. And then lastly, that you're able to write a compelling story. So it's not just about writing down what you want to do and researching it and understanding how you're going to be impactful. But it's also about being able to tell that story in a compelling and memorable way. And those are the things that I would say are my key takeaways, but I'm sure Takako also has something to add to that.
One concept that has helped us a lot this year is really focusing on those top 12 people and thinking about when was the last time that I spoke to this person? How can I follow up with this person about something that we discussed that maybe we made progress on and get back to this person about? Or is this some? Is there an interesting article that I read that I can send this person? But how do I continue to develop a stronger relationship with this person? I think that if you just focus in on those top 12 people, it makes it a lot less of an overwhelming task. And I think it's also just made the whole process just so much more human and joyful to know that we are on this journey to build this university, but at the same time, create really meaningful relationships with amazing people who have great accomplishments and great advice that we can learn from, and kind of switching our mindset that way that has made the fundraising journey so much more fun.
That's great. Well, and I think both those are great advice, like really writing it down, setting that goal down, then thinking about how you articulate it, but then also being really focused to start with that, you know, who are your dozen targets? Who are these dream people you want to talk to? Or the donors that come in, you know, being really intentional about growing them. This is great advice. So if someone wants to be a donor to Musisi University, where can they find out about you and how can they follow or donate?
Yes, they can visit our 501c3 website at musizifoundation.org. Musizi is spelled M-U-S-I-Z-I, foundation.org. You can also email us at info@musizifoundation.org, and we would love to hear from you.
That's great. And we'll put this link in the show notes to make it easy so you don't have to write it down if you're driving. But I'd encourage you, go ahead. If you're interested in this, donate to them. They are great, and both Takako and Elaine, they've been great to know, and we're excited to see the success that you have with the university. And thank you guys for being on the show.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. If you're interested in our upcoming workshop, visit our website at sevenfigurefundraising.com. We conduct these workshops twice a year in March and September, and we've broken these workshops up so you can take them live online with 6 2-hour courses spread over 3 weeks. We'll send you a workbook and other class materials to make it really easy for you to follow along. In fact, this is what one of our students, Austin, said about his experience in our workshop.
Hi, my name is Austin Brooks. I'm an executive director of a nonprofit called Midland Institute for Entrepreneurship. I took seven-figure fundraising 18 months ago. And since that course, two things I want to share. One is the results. Two is what I didn't expect. And the results as a nonprofit, even though we reach into 10 states, even though we're working in 320 high schools, we've always had a pretty small donor base. And what's been so powerful in the results that we've seen since this course is I've successfully been able to recruit and add some new donors that had never previously been given to our organization. And then more importantly, there's this idea that's gonna be shared in this course called the Dynamic Dozen. You have to take the course to figure out what it's about. But within our Dynamic Dozen, we had 5 donors increase their giving in a big way. And between that and the new donors, this has been a game changer for our growing nonprofit. But the second thing that I really took away that really matters is just the mindset shift. What I wasn't expecting was how much my mindset needed to shift, how much I had to just shift my poverty thinking or my scarcity mindset to realizing that whether there's a recession, whether we lose a couple donors, if your organization is doing good work, more people need to know about it. And so the confidence that I gained in terms of talking to high-level individuals who believe in our mission has just grown. And what's been more impressive than anything is the proof has been in the actual donors we've gained. So if I can do this, I believe you can. You can't miss this course. You got to take it.
If you're interested in attending, visit sevenfigurefundraising.com. We hope to see you there. And if you've been enjoying the podcast, please take 60 seconds to leave a review. Thanks a lot and good luck with your fundraising.